This is the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks on KQV with expert advice from CPA, attorney, and retirement and estate planning expert Jim Lang, best-selling author of Retire Secure and The Roth Revolution, Pay Taxes Once, Then Never Again. Now on air and worldwide, paytaxeslater.com. Now get ready to talk smart money.
And welcome to the Lang Money Hour. I'm Dan Weinberg, along with CPA and attorney Jim Lang. Tonight, we welcome David Blanchett to the program to talk about the ins and outs of retirement planning. David is head of retirement research at Morningstar Investment Management, LLC. And in that role, he works to enhance the group's consulting and investment services and conducts research primarily in the areas of financial planning, tax planning, annuities, and retirement. In 2014, Investment News included David in their inaugural 40 Under 40 list as a visionary for the financial planning industry. And in 2014, Money Magazine called him one of the brightest minds in retirement planning. He's a retire mentor for MarketWatch and an expert retirement panelist for the Wall Street Journal. And with that, let's get started on what should be a fascinating discussion about retirement by saying good evening to Jim Lang and David Blanchett.
Welcome, David.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming. The area that I really wanted to start off with, although I really want to concentrate on the safe withdrawal rates throughout the program, but there was an article written about articles that you have written by Jonathan Gooden, and he seemed to indicate something that I think a lot of our clients feel by common sense, which is, hey, I just retired, I'm young and healthy, or at least relatively young, maybe in their mid-60s. I'm healthy. I can travel. I can do things. I've watched my parents' lifestyle, and they had some health limitations as they got older, and they didn't spend nearly as much money. Can't I spend more money now while I can be young and I can enjoy it? And for whatever it's worth, I actually posed this exact same question to Bill Bengen, and he didn't like that idea. He said, hey, what you make up for in lack of traveling when you're older is additional health care costs. So he didn't want to distinguish between spending in the early part of your retirement and the later part of your retirement. And Jonathan Guyton seemed to think that you had a different idea on that. So if you could tell our listeners what you think about that idea, and then maybe we'll get into some of the more basics of the safe withdrawal rate.
Sure. So I've been doing research on this topic now for probably about a decade on how much someone needs to retire successfully. And there's all these assumptions we have to use in our models and doing research. We have to assume how long someone lives, the return on their assets, how much they spend each year. And one incredibly common assumption in retirement research, and it's used by financial planners, is that the retiree's income need or goal increases every year by inflation, right? So, for example, if you spent $50,000 last year and inflation was 3%, you'll spend 3% more the following year. Now, I've talked to planners for a long time, and planners have often kind of noted anecdotally that, hey, with a lot of my clients, they don't need this annual increase of inflation. They take some number less than that. And so I thought, well, that's an interesting observation. And so I said, well, let's look at the actual data. So there's this thing called the Health and Retirement Study. And in it, it actually tracks the same retiree households over time. So it asks them, hey, how much did you spend this year? How much did you spend a few years ago, et cetera? And so my goal is to say, okay, well, let's look at actual retiree consumption and see how it changes over time. And what you see is a few things. First, you see younger and older households. So let's define a younger retiree household as someone who's less than the age of, say, 65, and older, say, over the age of 85 or 90. Those household types tend to increase their spending by more than inflation. And then, again, this is all on average. There's always exceptions to the rule, but this is kind of the rule. So, for example, if you're a household married couple, average age of 58 years old, inflation goes up, say, 2%, those households spend maybe 3% more the following year on average. They're kind of increasing their consumption by more than inflation. The same thing with older households. But what's interesting is that middle range, between ages of, say, 65 and 85 or 90, consumption does decline. Now, to your earlier point, medical costs are a growing share of the overall consumption of households. So the average household at 65 years old spends about 10% on health care, right? The average retired household that's 85 years old, so 20 years older, spends about 20% on health care. And so here's the thing. There's kind of two different things at play here. One is that, health care costs, as we all know, have been growing faster than inflation. And so health care is definitely a bigger expenditure for retirees. They're spending more on health care, but they spend a lot less on everything else. And so what this means kind of net-net is that people on average, retirees, don't tend to increase their consumption in retirement every year by inflation. That can really reduce the overall cost of retirement and really change the way you think about how you should spend optimally, again, in retirement.
David, would it make a big difference in terms of, we're talking about, let's say, percentage of inflation? Let's say somebody retires with $500,000 in Social Security, and somebody else retires with $2 million plus a stronger Social Security. I assume that you would be recommending a different asset allocation for those two individuals. Do you think the same changes would apply? So, for example, maybe the person with $2 million would not be spending 20% of their available income on retirement, where somebody with $500,000 would.
Well, so there's a lot of kind of tricky things at play here. And so, one really important thing to think about when asking the question, what is a safe withdrawal rate and how should I invest my portfolio, is how much do I need to have this money, right? So if you can think about your retirement income goal as being need, wants, and wishes. I absolutely have to have $50,000 per year. I'd like to have $30,000 a year. And then I'd love it if I had an extra $20,000. And so that's really important because, if you have, the amount you need, that non-discretionary income coming from Social Security, then it allows you to be more aggressive with your initial withdrawal, which you could take more of your portfolio. But also to your point, it's how do you invest your portfolio? Well, it's important to think about all of your assets kind of holistically. And if you have a really, really large benefit from Social Security or from pensions, defined benefit plan, that is effectively a bond. It's a guaranteed form of income for your entire life. And so what I would recommend to clients is that, hey, if you have a lot of your income in Social Security, you should be more aggressive in your portfolio, but also you can probably take out more money from your portfolio through the withdrawals, because if you do happen to suffer a shortfall, if your portfolio goes down in value, it doesn't affect your overall consumption as much. Because, again, if 80% of your income, for example, is in Social Security or pensions, if your portfolio does fail or go to zero, it doesn't have that large effect on your overall spending as if it's a much lower percentage of your overall consumption.
That actually makes sense, and I love your use, and all throughout your articles you talk about, holistically, which I guess is sometimes maybe overdone, but I think sometimes clients go to sometimes even more than one advisor, and they say, okay, I'm going to give you $500,000 and see how you do, and I'm going to give you advisor number B $500,000, see how you do, when really I think the value of an advisor is looking at the whole thing. And I love your needs, wants, and wishes buckets. So I guess coming back to the initial point, is it fair, and I don't know, maybe we should even go back a step further and start with your starting point. So, for example, Bill Bengen's starting point would be for a 30-year retirement, 4%, and then 4% inflation year two, 4% plus inflation year three, et cetera, theoretically without having the need to even look at the portfolio every year. Do you have a starting point for asset allocation and safe withdrawal rate, or is that just too broad a question and you need to, let's say, define parameters a little better?
So I do. I mean, I think that, you know, a good starting point for retirees today is a balanced portfolio. So between maybe, you know, 40% to 60% stocks. But, you know, that varies, again, a lot by overall client situation and client preferences. But you know, you raised a point about kind of, you know, all these different assumptions, right? So, you know, when talking about, you know, Bill Bingen's research and, you know, what is a safe withdrawal rate or amount from a portfolio, there's really kind of three really key assumptions you have to make. The first is how long retirement lasts. And the most common assumption there is 30 years, okay? And there's different reasons for that. But an interesting kind of note for your listeners is that, you know, for a married couple today who is relatively well off, so let's just say first or second highest decile of income, the odds of one member of that couple living more than 30 years is about 50-50. So historically, a 30-year retirement was a reasonable assumption, in my opinion, for a married couple who are both 65 years old. Today, it isn't nearly as safe because we're living a lot longer than we used to. Second, it's rate of return. Right. So what we've done mostly in research is we've assumed that historical returns in the stock market are reasonable for investors today. Well, you know, if we've all watched the news, you know, yields on bonds are well less than 10%. And these are 10-year government bonds. Right. And an important point there is that the long-term average yield on 10-year U.S. government bonds is closer to 5%. So we're easily seeing today 3% less in yield than the long-term average. This has significant impact on expected returns going forward because it isn't realistic to assume that the returns we've experienced in the U.S. over the last, you know, 100 or so years will continue in the future. And then finally, so we've talked about already, is this idea, you know, what is the actual consumption look like? You know, Bill Bingen, again, the most common assumption is that, you know, I take out 4% in year one, then I increase that amount by inflation every year thereafter. I think that, you know, in reality, the 4% rule isn't named correctly. It should be a 25 times rule, right? And so what I'm talking about here is that the 4% only applies to the first year of retirement. And so what you need is you can take out 4% of your portfolio, and 1 divided by 4% is 25 times. So historically, using historical data based upon a 30-year retirement, you need 25 times your portfolio income goal when you first retire. Okay, here's the thing, though, right? That's based upon historical returns, historical life expectancy. And when you change those assumptions to be more realistic, when you use maybe a more realistic retirement period, you use forward-looking returns, that number easily goes up to, say, 30 or 35 times your income goal, but it's based upon, again, how much certainty you need around that goal. If you're willing to take some possibility of changes over time, it can be much less than that.
I think this is a really important point. So if we could, I'm going to go backwards for a minute. Why don't we talk about, and let's use even numbers to make it easy. Let's say somebody has $1 million. And let's even assume the way I handle the safe withdrawal number of years needed is I usually just ask people about their health, whether they have cancer, whether they have a heart condition, how long their parents lived, what their general condition is. And then I try to be conservative. That is, if they say they think they'll make it till 85 or 90, then I might, you know, add another 5 or 10 years on top of that to be safe. But, you know, let's say for the $1 million guy, Bill Bingen's was very easy. Okay, 4% first year, 4% times $1 million was $40,000. Year two is $40,000 plus 1 year of inflation. Can you give us an example on the 25 times rule?
Well, sure. So for the 25 times rule, you know, 4% of $1 million is $40,000. $40,000 times 25 is $1 million. So if I'm a retiree using historical research on safe withdrawal amounts or rates, and I wanted to have $40,000 a year of income from a portfolio, this is kind of on top of money from Social Security or pensions, I should have saved 25 times that, about $1 million at retirement.
Okay, and then what about year two?
Well, so then, you know, year two, you would just take out that amount plus inflation. So again, the initial multiple is only relevant really for the first year of retirement. It assumes that you have that amount, and then you kind of increase that initial withdrawal amount by inflation every year. So what I think, you know, what's instructive about the research is really more for people who are in accumulation, kind of saying, hey, I'm targeting saving X dollars for retirement. What should my target be? Or two, you know, how much do I have to save to achieve my, you know, same level of spending in retirement as I do today?
Well, playing the devil's advocate, one of the potential issues of doing it that way is, wouldn't you have a variation of spending depending on if your portfolio had a good year or a bad year?
Well, right. And so that's why, you know, it's important to kind of apply smoothing rules. And so, you know, one important thing is that 4% is only the initial withdrawal rate. So in effectively year one of retirement, that's the percentage withdrawal. And then, you know, using this logic, it would be plus or minus inflation. Now, in reality, the rules we use for clients are much more complex than that, right? You know, no one is going to follow the same set of logic or rules for 30 years in retirement. In reality, it's much more dynamic. You're going to kind of make changes over time. And so it's kind of like an endowment, right? Endowments for universities, they spend a certain percentage of the portfolio based upon the average of the last 3 years' values. And so what you would do for a retiree is you want to revisit that withdrawal amount from the portfolio over time to ensure it's reasonable. Now, a very interesting point, though, or thing to be aware of is that, you know, the level of safety you need in terms of that income really defines that starting point. And so if you're someone that says, you know what, David, I have a lot of money from my pension, from Social Security. You know, if my portfolio goes down in value, I've got to cut back. I'm willing to do that, but I'm willing to take a risk. And so I would say, okay, maybe take out 5% in the first year of retirement. However, if you're someone who says, you know, David, I don't have almost any money from Social Security. I don't have any money from pensions. I need this portfolio to provide income for life. I don't want to annuitize. I might say, well, 3% is a better starting point. And so, you know, how high that level of withdrawals is in that first year of retirement is really dictated based upon that individual's kind of preference for safety with that income amount.
All right. Now, earlier you had alluded to if you had some fixed income, whether it be a pension or Social Security, that you could afford to have a higher allocation of stocks. Would the same thing apply here? So that if you, let's say you had a pension, that you could in effect say, okay, I could effectively afford to take out more money right now, because if my portfolio goes south, my pension will still be, let's say, fill up the needs buckets and part of the wants buckets. Is that a fair assumption, or is that not really accurate?
It is. And so I think that when thinking about like the risk of a portfolio, there's lots of different things to think about. I think that the most common thing that we as investment professionals or advisors focus on is risk tolerance. And you'll take what's called a risk tolerance questionnaire. It asks you, you know, how do you feel about the market dropping 20%? And to me, that's risk preference. It's asking someone, you know, how would you react or feel based upon different market environments? And so, you know, for example, if you're someone who, as a client, just cannot tolerate portfolio volatility at all. You know, you just hate seeing the market go up and down. You know, that might drive how you invest your portfolio. The other side of the coin, it's risk capacity. It's how much risk should you take in your portfolio, given your goals, your assets, etc. And so, you know, when thinking about things like Social Security, that is talking to your risk capacity. How much risk can I afford to take in my portfolio, given kind of all of my stuff? The other part, again, is risk preference. And so, you know, again, yes, I would say that, you know, for retirees that get most of their income from pension and Social Security, you know, you really should probably have a more aggressive portfolio on average than someone who doesn't. However, you know, if you're a retiree who says, you know what, David, I understand that I could take on more risk, but I just don't like market risk, then that preference to be conservative may dominate that risk capacity perspective to be more aggressive.
Yes, I wrestle with this issue with clients all the time, because I personally want people who have retired relatively recently, who are enjoying good health, to get the most out of their remaining years and I want to go, let's say, within comfort levels to, let's say, get people to spend up to what is safe. Now, the areas that you, one of the things that you said is, let's assume somebody doesn't want to annuitize, and I'm not talking about a tax-deferred annuity, but rather an immediate annuity, which is, let's call it a low-cost method of guaranteeing income. And the other thing is, and I don't know if you include this as, let's say, a potential in the asset allocation mix, but I'm seeing more and more of it, is let's say somebody has a $600,000 paid-off house, and they could easily get a line of credit, or if it ever really came to it, a reverse mortgage. I don't know if that would play into account the safe withdrawal rate that you would consider, and whether you could consider some of those resources as potential income.
I would say definitely. I would say that, you know, the home is an asset that it's the most interesting asset that we have, because it's both a investment and a consumption good, right? If you don't own a home, you have to rent. And so by owning a home, you have what's called implied rent. And so if you live in a house that's totally paid off, that is kind of an asset of last resort. And so having that allows you to take on more risk with your overall plan. And more risk can mean different things. You can take on more risk in your portfolio. You can take on more risk with a higher withdrawal rate, or both. But again, it provides that kind of level of safety that if you don't own a home, you just don't have that asset with that value. So it doesn't leave you as many choices should things go poorly.
All right. I'm finding this very interesting. And the other thing that's interesting is we happen to use that exact same terminology, needs, wants, and wishes. So a lot of the things that you are talking about is consistent with what we have been doing. David, you said something that I have long advocated that clients don't usually like to hear. So whatever your asset allocation recommendation might be, if let's say somebody was a renter, and now I want to compare that to what the asset allocation should be if they have, say, a $500,000 paid-off house. And what you had implied or even stated is that those two people with identical portfolios, one that has a $500,000 house and one that is renting, can be different. And I often want to include, and this is, by the way, Jonathan Clemens' rule of thumb. Jonathan Clemens would say, and he actually did an article about this in the Wall Street Journal, that if you have let's say a $500,000 house, he would take a multiple of 60% of that. So now we're at 300,000. And let's just use the 4% rule of thumb, if you will. So he would say, okay, you can spend an extra $12,000 a year if you have a paid up house, on the theory that if push ever came to shove, A, you could get a line of credit, or B, if it really came to it, you could get a reverse mortgage, or C, in the extreme, you could sell the house. So could you, and by the way, one of the great things about having you on is that A, you're not trying to sell anything, and B, you have credentials, with all due respect, out the wazoo, you know, written a million peer-review articles, head of research of probably the top researcher organization. So to hear this from you is, frankly, a lot more meaningful. So could you tell us about how you see the having a paid-up house has having an impact on your asset allocation and retirement planning?
Right. So there's a really important word there, and that's a paid-up house. The riskiest asset for a lot of younger households is actually their home, right? We think about the risk of home. I'm actually doing a paper on this exact topic right now. And, you know, the homes are actually pretty risky, especially when you add on a mortgage that's, you know, 80% or more of the home value. It's a 5x leveraged investment, right? But for someone who's in retirement, who has the house totally paid for, you know, that is an asset that's kind of a means of last resort. And so I don't know about, you know, like what is the right rule of thumb to say, well, you know, your home is worth $500,000. You can increase your withdrawal amount by this. But you know, the important question there is, well, you know, what do you want to do with that asset? If you're willing to kind of think of the home as an asset to possibly fund retirement, then you should definitely increase your withdrawal rate. Because I think that, that too often, you know, we run these financial plans for clients and we only talk about failure. You know, oh my goodness, you know, what if you, you know, what are the odds of having nothing left when you're 95 years old or 100? Well, you know, another definition of failure that is totally overlooked is, what if I didn't enjoy my life the best I possibly could? And right, so to me, you know, failure is not just having no money at the age of 95. It's having too much money. And a home is an example of an asset that, hey, if it's out there and you're willing to kind of access it, it should definitely affect your financial plan. You know, it definitely allows you to be more aggressive with your withdrawal rate and possibly more aggressive with your portfolio. So, you know, a lot of folks don't like thinking about their home as an asset to fund retirement, but, you know, hey, it's there, you know, you own it outright, you might as well.
Well, the way I sometimes think about it is, I'm not telling people to go get a mortgage immediately or to get a reverse mortgage if cash flow is okay, which, by the way, I have heard that advocated. I have heard, hey, it just makes sense. Get a reverse mortgage. Even with the additional cost, you're going to get an extra $5,000-$10,000 a year, and you can see that coming in every month, and you'll spend that, and you'll have a more fun and healthier retirement. And I usually don't go that far, but what I like to do is I say, okay, you have this $500,000 house. Let's not ignore it. Let's look at that as a potential use of assets, because when we're talking about safe withdrawal rates, what we're usually talking about is, in effect, if things go worse than we expect and we still want to be okay. But like you said, it is a risk to have too much money, to not have traveled, to not have had vacations, or Jonathan Clemens, in my favorite way of spending money for retirees, is to fund family vacations. But is, in your analysis, is it fair to maybe not say, okay, we're going to get a reverse mortgage whether we need it or not and spend it, but to just have that as a safeguard, and knowing that it is there, be able to either spend more or change our asset allocation a little bit more towards equities or some combination of the two?
Yeah, that's totally right. I actually wrote a paper that was published last year that was called No Portfolio is an Island. And I think that too often when building portfolios, and this is really, I think, advisors that don't do more kind of holistic financial planning, they may view a portfolio as an island. They may say, hey, you know, I've got this great active manager, whatever else it is that they think is spectacular. Well, to me, you know, this idea of comprehensive planning is incredibly valuable, because what it does is it gives you the ability to work with someone that, you know, that gives you complete advice. It just doesn't say, hey, you know, a portfolio can be great in isolation, but it could be horrible for someone based upon all their facts and circumstances. And so to me, you know, incorporating this idea of, you know, what is the risk of a home? How does it affect your portfolio? Is really just an incredibly valuable aspect of why you work with someone and why financial planning really helps someone achieve a better retirement.
I agree with you. And I think it's really important for people to understand that I believe that one of the, if not the greatest, I would even say the most important facet of working with a financial advisor is not necessarily somebody who's going to say, oh, okay, I'm going to beat the S&P by 2 or 3% even after fees, which frankly hasn't really been borne out by the vast majority anyway, but by somebody who is going to take a look at the whole picture, find out what people's, again, using your words, but we use the same words, needs, wants, wishes, take into consideration things like pensions. And then the other issue is, let's say, variations. So, for example, I'll see a lot of the pensions will be for, that is, one life, that meaning that if somebody dies, their spouse doesn't get anything. And I like your idea of looking at the whole picture, but taking into consideration the house is a very useful asset that should be looked at much differently than if you don't have a house. And then the ability to annuitize, even though people hardly ever do it. I think that these are two potential ways to increase people's ability to spend more money without seriously risking running out of money. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, I actually wrote a paper, and this goes even further back. It was titled Alpha, Beta, and Now Gamma. And for those of your listeners that don't know our fancy terms we use in the investment field, alpha is picking funds that outperform their peers. So if you bought a mutual fund that invests in large cap stocks, and it outperforms its respective benchmark by 1%, that's alpha. Beta is building good portfolios. What I'm calling gamma is everything else. It's all the financial planning stuff. And I think that too often people in this industry get too focused on alpha and beta, you know, which is picking good investments and building good portfolios. And it's obviously important to do that. But what is vastly more important in terms of helping someone accomplishing a goal is everything else, which is what I call gamma, or you could just call it smart financial planning. And so, again, the message isn't that it isn't worthwhile to build good portfolios, but just to your point, helping someone accomplish that goal is why people seek advice. And that, it's hard to quantify, right? You know, it's easy to kind of ask the question, hey, you know, how did my portfolio do versus the S&P 500, right? But the problem with those types of questions is it ignores all the stuff that you're doing as a planner to help that client actually accomplish that goal.
Well, frankly, this plays in very well with the way we actually run our practice. And at the risk of sounding a little bit self-serving, to me, issues like how much and when should you make a Roth IRA conversion? What is the best Social Security strategy in your particular situation? And frankly, it also has an impact on estate planning. Well, what if the husband dies? What if the wife dies? Is insurance part of this? And I think what you're saying is some of these issues, which frankly is what I like to do in my time, because the arrangement that we have in our office is our office actually works on these types of issues. We're very quantitative. We, quote, run the numbers, and we come up with what we believe is the ideal Roth IRA conversion strategy, the ideal Social Security strategy. And then PJ, using low-cost index funds, specifically dimensional funds, looks at needs, wants, wishes, and the two firms kind of work together to try to come up with a solution. But I think that it's great hearing somebody with as many credentials as you saying, hey, it's not all about alpha. In fact, Larry Swedros, we're doing a show called Disappearing Alpha. And now, even though we're talking about beta, I guess, that beta isn't everything, and that what you're calling gamma is actually right. But one of the things I wanted to do is, and I know that people don't like to simplify, particularly a guy like you who is writing many, many articles that have a lot of nuances in them. But if you could we have the David Blanchett safe withdrawal rule of thumbs analysis that our listeners could go by?
Sure. So, you know, I think it's important to kind of, you know, reiterate to your point that everyone is very different, and it's difficult to kind of say, hey, this works for everyone. And I think that's where the value of planning really comes into play. But, you know, people always want to know, well, you know, what is a reasonable expectation, right? And at the end of the day, I think that, you know, a 4% initial withdrawal rate, so you need 25 times your income goal, is still a good starting point, right? Because most people have Social Security benefits, they've got pension benefits, et cetera. But that range really varies between 3% to easily over 5% based upon mostly that person's flexibility with change, right? Because, you know, in all these metrics that we talk about, even the 4% rule, there's kind of safety in there, saying, okay, well, you know, most of the time you're going to be totally fine. It's only if things go poorly. Well, the question really, I think, for a lot of people to ask themselves is again, it's this concept of need, wishes, and wants. You know, how much do you have to have every year in retirement? And, you know, if that number, you know, isn't covered from Social Security or pensions, if most of that's coming in your portfolio, then your number's probably closer to 3%, right? But if you're someone that says, hey, David, you know, I've got so much income from Social Security, and even then, you know, if I've got to cut back, if things are bad, I'm totally fine with that. 5% is probably better. But again, I think that, you know, working with a planner to kind of talk through what your goals are is critically important to figuring out what that number is initially, but then also how things change. Because I'm sure you've seen this, you know, you can do a plan that, you know, is for someone, you know, 30 or 40 years, but things always change. And the key is kind of saying, hey, you know, this was the plan 5 years ago. Things have changed. How do I update that to kind of make sure it best reflects my current goals and desires?
This is very helpful. And by the way, when you said everybody's different, our terminology is that everybody's a snowflake. So this is pretty consistent. The other thing that you had mentioned earlier in the show is you talked about the needs, wants, and wishes. And so, for example, the way PJ Denuso and our firm work is we tend to, rather than lumping, let's say we're investing $1 million for somebody, rather than saying, okay, you have a $1 million portfolio and we're going to invest that 60% stocks and 40% bonds, and the 60% stocks is going to be X percent international, X percent large, and X percent small, and X percent value, X percent blah, 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 and all the sub-variations. But you had mentioned off-air that it is easier and sometimes more productive for people to think about it, their portfolio in terms of buckets. So could you tell our listeners about what you think would be a good, let's say, bucket analysis or a good way to think about it, particularly if the advisor is literally willing to have separate accounts that even together might look like a well-diversified portfolio, but rather than having it all in one pot, they literally have different pots. And I think people are familiar with this idea. So, for example, with the Christmas club or the vacation fund or the wedding fund, etc. But can you tell us a little bit about the way you think in terms of buckets? Because I know that actually it doesn't matter what I bring up. I know that you've written a wonderful article on it.
Sure. So to me, this is thinking about behavioral, right? I am not a behavioral researcher. I am more of an academic researcher. I just focus on kind of the numbers. Well, you know, there's a difference from saying, okay, you know, you should be in a portfolio that's 60% stocks and 40% bonds. Okay. But the question is, well, how do you get there as a client? And, you know, clients, and this is retirees, have different perspectives on risk. And one thing that I think that's very valuable is kind of breaking the portfolio apart based upon different goals, different time horizons. In reality, if you could invest, you know, all of your money in a single portfolio, that would be fine. But, you know, to your point, I think that, you know, showing someone, hey, you know, let's think of this $1 million in different distinct buckets. And you've got $100,000 set aside to fund your spending in cash for the next 2 years. You might have a boat fund. You might have a second retirement home fund. And then you kind of segment it based upon time horizon. What you end up seeing is, let's just say you have one big portfolio, but you kind of cut it into seven smaller portfolios. And, you know, some may say, well, what's the point? You know, in my experience personally as an advisor, it better helps clients kind of understand how the portfolio is helping them accomplish their goals. Now, what it won't do is it doesn't necessarily help you, you know, have a higher rate of return. I've seen, you know, people that have done things that says, hey, having buckets, you know, leads to better outcomes in terms of market timing. Well, it doesn't do that, but it definitely helps clients better understand how their money that's going to fund their retirement and fund their goals.
Is it possible that it would also give somebody some reassurance that they wouldn't go out of the market in the event that there is some type of downturn or scary event, whether it's Brexit or something else, because they say, oh, okay, well, we have actually already allocated two years of money for my needs bucket. that is in cash or maturing CDs or a bond ladder, etc. So I have time for the market to rebound and I don't have to get nervous and sell. So is it possible that, again, I know that you said you're not a behavioral researcher, but is it possible that having the buckets would actually help somebody stay on course?
I think definitely so. And, you know, at Morningstar, we calculate different rates of returns for investments, mutual funds, for example. And there's this thing called the total return. The total return is what you would receive if you were to buy the investment and hold it over the entire time horizon. So, you know, if you bought a fund on January 1st, 2011, you held it to December 31st, the end of the year, that's your total return. What's interesting is that we also estimate investor returns. Investor returns are actually kind of the realized returns by the average investor. And investor returns are almost always lower than total returns because people time the market. They kind of, you know, they go in at the wrong time, they exit at the wrong time. And what you see with buckets, to your point, is that, you know, it helps people realize higher rates of return because it creates this belief or perception that people can wait and that, you know, that, hey, if I only have one portfolio that's invested in 50% equities, I can't afford to lose any money at all. Well, you actually can, because investing is a difficult long-term endeavor, and showing someone that, hey, you, to your point, you've got this cash bucket that's in the last 2 years, you can afford to wait this out, and it can better help them realize higher rates of return over the long haul.
Let me ask you another question about buckets. So let's say for discussion's sake that most people have a variety of investments that are in different tax environments. So a lot of times our typical client will have what I would call after-tax dollars, meaning money that they have already paid income tax on, and that could maybe be separated into high basis, meaning that if they sold it, there would not be a capital gain, and low basis, meaning if they sold it, there would be a capital gain. And then they might have, at least for most of our clients, they probably have the majority of their money in their retirement plan, whether it's a 401k or a 403b or a SEP or a KEO, or maybe after they retire, often it has been rolled into an IRA. And then, and particularly if they work with us, we love to run the numbers, and we often recommend a series of Roth IRA conversions. So it would be very typical for one of our clients to have at least those three different types, or I guess I mentioned four different types of tax buckets, if you will. And then, although we don't advocate them, but people do come in with commercial annuities, and that might be another one. Is there a way that you would say, okay, with these different tax environments, and let's just keep it simple and say high basis after tax, low basis after tax, IRA and Roth IRA, would you invest these different tax environments in different buckets?
Well, I mean, I think this to me is this idea of asset location and how do you think about investing money. It gets very complex in terms of how do you invest buckets and how do you fund retirement. But, you know, at a high level, one kind of general recommendation that I always have is that if, let's just go back to that hypothetical 60% equity portfolio. If you have different account types, if you have a Roth IRA, a taxable account, or traditional money, they all shouldn't be invested the same, right? And so that may be your kind of overall asset allocation. But if you're doing, again, kind of more comprehensive or holistic planning, you're going to say that, you know, your higher returning assets should be in a Roth-type vehicle. Your very tax-inefficient investments, like, for example, high-yield bonds, should be in your traditional monies. And then those that are left in your taxable accounts should really be your most efficient investments from a tax perspective. So to me, again, this gets into the idea of customization, kind of acknowledging that, hey, you may have a single global target for your asset allocation, but most of your accounts should be invested differently based upon the tax status of the account and the overall kind of efficiency of the investments that you're going to choose to purchase.
All right. Well, so in that analysis, isn't there an inherent conflict between the IRA tends to be invested a little bit longer and therefore we should have riskier assets such as stocks. But then you just said, well, if let's say we have a high yield bond, that should be in the IRA because it's more tax efficient. Is there an inherent conflict there where you have, let's say, two different forces pitted against each other? One is, let's say, long-term investment goals, and the other is tax efficiency?
Yeah, so there are a variety of goals there. There's this idea of tax alpha. How do I maximize the after-tax rate of return for my clients? And, you know, one thing you don't want to, for example, do is you don't want to put very tax-inefficient assets in a taxable account. Because if you do that, your realized rate of return is going to be quite small, because you're going to first pay taxes every year on the gains, and then the tax rate you pay is going to be a very high marginal tax rate. So the key, I think, is just thinking, how do I maximize my after-tax rate of return? And what that, you know, for me right now, that leads to mostly is first make sure the very, very tax inefficient investments aren't in a taxable account. But beyond that, you know, we're in a place today where bond yields are so low, the traditional logic that, hey, you've got to have all of your bond money in a traditional or non-taxable investment isn't necessarily true. So to me, the honest question for a lot of people is, you know, how efficient are your risky investments? If you're buying actively managed mutual funds, it may actually make more sense to have those in your IRA and have your bonds in your taxable account, again, based upon how tax efficient they are.
Well, David, you have given us so much great information. I really appreciate it. I'm sure our listeners do. Some very valuable information from somebody who doesn't sell anything and doesn't have any axe to grind, if you will. So I want to thank you again. We have about 1 minute left. Is there any other one thing that you could say in 1 minute that you want our listeners to know?
You know, again, I just think that it's retirement is the most expensive purchase you're ever going to make. It really makes sense to receive professional, unbiased advice if you can get it. You only retire once. Don't screw it up.
All right. Thank you so much, David, for your terrific research and the insights that you shared with us tonight. Of course, thanks to Jim Lang as well. You can check out the archives at paytaxeslater.com. All of our episodes are archived on the Lang Financial Group's website soon after they air. Special thanks, as always, to the Lang Financial Group's Marketing Director, Amanda Cassidy Schweinsberg, and to our producer today, KQB's Amy Villela.
Thanks for listening to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks. Check out the show archives and listen on demand anytime at paytaxeslater.com.